Episode 397 of CPP Cast with guest Daisy Holman. Recorded 28th of April 2025. In this episode, we talk about new releases of Clang, Boost, and N. Lohman Jason, upcoming conferences, and then we talk to Daisy Holman about using generative AI as a tool to help with software development. Welcome to episode 397 of CPP Cast, the first podcast for C++ developers by C++ developers. I'm your host, Phil Nash, joined by my guest co-host, Anastasia Kezakova. Anastasia, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Just recovering from the ACCU conference, which was a few weeks ago now. And now I'm off to Paris tomorrow to speak at the C++ meetup there. So traveling never seems to end here. How about yourself?
I'm good. I quickly recovered from ACCU because I had further travel, but we luckily handled a nice meetup here in Amsterdam, talking about Bazel for C++ developers.
Oh, nice.
So it was a little bit more of C++ as usual.
Right. Yeah, you can't get away from C++. So.
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, we'll get more into C++ in a bit. But at the top of every episode, we do like to read a piece of feedback. This one is from an email from Abe Mishler. So Abe says, I'm really enjoying the CPP Cast podcast. Listen to it while I drive to and from work as a software developer. I would like it if you could talk on the topic of G++ and glibc versions that come with different versions of Linux, and specifically their ABI incompatibilities. Now, that is a big topic. We haven't really covered ABI stability for a while. Maybe it's time to do that one again. It's an evergreen topic, I think. He does go on to like compare some different ABI stability issues between different GCC and Linux versions, and compares that with Windows, which I presume he means Visual Studio, Visual C++. Interestingly, that whole situation used to be reversed years ago. It used to be Visual C++ always broke compatibility, but big topic, as I say.
Yeah, it would be interesting to cover that. Yeah, I remember you had a speech, actually. There was ABI compatibility topic at CPPcast some time ago. That was actually, I remember, I was swimming, listening to the episode, talking about right. Driving to work and listening to episode. And it was quite a longish one. So I remember I had a long swim because of that, but it was super interesting.
Yes, it's with ABI, it's definitely sink or swim. So Abe's email is actually a two-parter, because he goes on to say, and also related to compiler versions, I've enjoyed listening to you discuss new C++ 26 features and proposals. So that's nice to hear, because most of the feedback we get is, you're talking too much about upcoming C++. We want some real-world stuff. So at least somebody's listening. But he says, it seems to take a long time for these features to make their way into GCC. Not sure about Clang or others. After so many years of stagnation in the language, what caused all of the recent and frequent developments in the C++ language, especially since compiler writers do take so long to implement them? Another big topic, which maybe we could do a whole episode on at some point, but funny enough, I've done a talk on this recently called Not Your Grandparents C++. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But I think the short answer is there was that period between 1998 and 2011, C++ 98, C++ 11, where there was no new standard if you ignore C++ 03, which is really like a patch release. And so people got used to the idea that C++ was pretty much unchanging. And then we switched to that train model where we have a new release every 3 years. So everybody's trying to get their proposals in for the next version. And that's really been quite a change in the dynamic, mostly for good, but not all for good, of course. But maybe we'll pick up that topic as well in the future. So thank you, Abe. We would like to hear your thoughts about the show. You can always email us at feedback@cppcast.com. That is our preferred way now. But we can still be reached on X, Mastodon, or LinkedIn. We just don't check them quite as often these days. So joining us today is Daisy Holman. Dr. Daisy S. Holman is a programming language expert who recently joined Anthropic after a decade of influential work on the C++ Standards Committee, where she made significant contributions to features like MDSpan, Atomic Ref, and the foundations of std execution. With a PhD in quantum chemistry and expertise spanning generic programming, metaprogramming, concurrency, and multidimensional arrays, Dr. Holman has dedicated her career to making complex programming abstractions more accessible. At Anthropic, she now applies her extensive C++ knowledge to exploring how programming languages, like C++ and Rust, will evolve alongside AI systems. Driven by her belief that better programming languages and AI systems can increase economic mobility and create more equitable technology. Daisy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I had my mic turned off because I was worried about interrupting. There was so much exciting stuff in the intro. I was like, I'm going to accidentally jump in if I don't turn my mic off. So it's nice to be on the show again.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And yeah, like, congrats with the first podcast bingo, getting kicked, like, forgotten to turn on the mic. I did it also a few times. Yeah, it's actually, I was wondering, you have so many impressive stuff in your bio, and how does it feel there in the future? I mean, you live 3 or 4 months ahead of us all. So how does it feel there? Is it good?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's constantly scary, but it's also, it's exciting, and it's, everything is evolving so quickly around me. And I'm just incredibly privileged to have gotten to be at Anthropic right at the heart of all of this at this time. I always tell the story that I missed two different opportunities to jump into AI world, one right after my PhD. My PhD is actually in an area that is much more closely related to machine learning than you would think. The math is very similar in quantum chemistry, and had that opportunity, and I was like, oh, AI is a fad, it's gonna pass, it's fine. And then even with the multidimensional arrays work, I had a lot of opportunities to really focus back in on the parts of multidimensional arrays that were really important to machine learning and to AI. And I thought, oh, this is a passing fad. And then I got my third opportunity and I didn't miss it. So I have never prepared so much for an interview in my life. I've never wanted a job so much in my life. This is so incredible, and I'm just really lucky to be a part of it.
Well, third time's the charm. Yeah. So I'm going to break the rules. I've got a comment in your bio as well, because I've got a confession to make, which is that I took the bio you had for the ACC conference, which was about 3 paragraphs long, which I thought was a bit too much to fit into this read. In fact, it was still quite long anyway. And then I fed that to Claude and asked it to summarize it for the podcast for me. And this is what it actually produced. So this is a Claude-generated bio.
Yeah, I think the funny thing about that is that, the original, my bio originally was generated by Claude also. I actually was playing around with our new web search feature, which is now public and has been public for a while, and had Claude search for information on me and for what matters to me. And I crafted a prompt that was very careful and everything. I mean, this is, prompting is a big part of all of this. We'll get into that. But yeah, and I said, can you write something up on me? And I liked it so much. It was very flattering. Claude is a sweetie, but it's really this full circle thing of like Claude summarizing itself. It's really cute.
So we've addressed one of the concerns people have already, which is what happens when you feed AI-generated stuff to AI-generated stuff, and we can still get some decent results. But yeah. Well, we'll see how that holds up. We'll get into that in the main topic. So before we do that, we do have a few news articles to talk about. So I really feel free to comment on any of these. So first of all, we've got a few releases to catch up on. And I say catch up because it's been a few weeks again since the last episode, so some of these are a little bit older, like the Clang 20 release. That was a few weeks ago now. I think we just missed it last time we recorded. So as usual, the first public release of a new Clang major release is a .1, so this is 20.1. And I put all the release notes on the show notes, but just a few highlights I picked out. One is that they got a lifetime extension in range-based for loops. In there, that was the the fix that Nico Jesaitis put in to C++ 26, but I think it's been retrofitted back to previous versions as a bug fix. So under certain situations, lifetimes could be extended when you create a temporary as part of a range-based for loop where previously it wouldn't have done, which was quite surprising behavior. So that's really nice. Seems like a little thing, but actually can make a big difference. That's in. They've implemented module-level lookup for C++ 20 modules, which seems like something that just got missed previously. Good to see module support sort of creaking closer and closer to actually being usable. So another step along the way. And then something that originally went to Clang 18, which was the explicit this parameter. That's the deducing this proposal in C++ 23. So that got into Clang 18, but what they didn't put in was the feature macro for it, so you can actually detect it. That's now in Clang 20. So nice little rounding out. Not a rounding outs, I think, in Clang 20. So that's good to see.
Looking forward to the next things coming in Clang. I've been messing around, and some of you may have seen me on Twitch messing around in between jobs with Clang and learning how all of that world works and trying to implement some of the reflection stuff. And that is a whole nother journey getting involved in Clang. But I think those are all good features to be seeing, a feature macro. I'm surprised they didn't just backport the feature macro, but I guess that you can't break people. I don't know. Yeah, deducing this is great. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to play around with it in real code, but it simplifies so many things.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you still use CRTP for certain reasons, deducing this is pretty amazing.
Yeah, one of those features that has a number of applications beyond the original use case, so that's always a good sign.
It's so much, it makes things so much easier in generic coding, generic programming, and anything that I've done with ranges has just been fantastic with it.
So the next release is Boost 1.88. That's got two new libraries in it, Hash2, an extensible hashing framework, which I haven't actually tried it myself, but I took a look at the docs and some of the Reddit comments on it as well. And seems like a pretty high quality framework for creating and composing hash code, which is an important, but maybe slightly boring part of normal coding, but important to get it right, I think, and very easy to get it wrong, shall we say. So nice to see that in Boost. And also MQTT5, a client library built on top of Boost Azio, I think. And that's for IoT messaging, which is not something I'm really in the world of, so I can't really say more about it, but nice to see, quite a big, useful library getting to Boost, still active development going on over there.
Yeah, that all sounds great. I haven't used Boost in years. I know that this community is good. I'm going to get a lot of pushback from that, but certainly good to see development still happening on top of Azio. And hashing. Oh, the other comment I had was that hashing is, I know Abseil had a big push to fix their hashing stuff. Or I think it was their hash tables being weird, but some of their hashes were not optimal. And this is one of those things that really gives you kind of step function performance improvements and you don't even know about it. It's very, very specialized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's why you really want the right people working on that stuff. Talking of having the right people working on things, there's a new version of JSON for modern C++. That's Nils Lohmann's library. We had him on the show a few months ago. So 3.12 is out. Again, I'll put all the release notes up on in the show notes. Couple of highlights. Diagnostic byte positions. So basically just the byte position through the parse now is part of the diagnostic if there's an error. Really useful because it's, if you're just parsing strings and you get an error, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly where that happens. So nice little addition. Support for conversions to and from stood optional. So always nice. And one for you, Daisy, multi-dimensional arrays now supported in a JSON context. I don't know what that looks like on the JSON side, but it's supported in the library. So there you go. Go and have a look.
Is that MD span or is that just T-star or something.
Yeah, I took a very, very small look, and it just seemed to be like, C-style multi-dimensional. Maybe it works with MD-SPAN. I haven't looked closely enough, but I think it tends to track a standard or two behind, so maybe not.
Ah, so they wouldn't have MD-SPAN anyway.
Yeah. So that was the releases roundup. Brief roundup of conferences. So there's a 2025 edition of the Pure Virtual C++ conference. That's all online. Half a day, really, on the 30th of April. Still completely free. There's five live talks going on, and then there's some pre-conference recordings going out as well. So I think they're considered part of the content. So you can watch those at any time. They're going to be going out from potentially now, I think. And then five talks on the day. So definitely take part in that, because why not? As we speak right now, in fact, maybe in an hour or two, I'm not sure. I haven't checked the time zones, but I think C++ now should just be starting. So you're probably too late to get there, because it'll be finished by the time this airs. I mentioned it just because it'll be rude not to. Obviously a great conference. The videos, I'm sure, will be out in a few months. The next conference you can actually get to would be C++ on C, which, for those of you that that don't know, for full disclosure, is a conference that I run. That's in Folkestone in the UK, 23rd to the 25th of June. We did mention it last time, so I won't talk too much about it this time, just to say that the full speaker list has now been announced, and the full schedule will be out soon. If the guess out in time, I'll put that in the show notes as well. Otherwise, just the speaker list, so you can see who is speaking. And then another C++ with C. C++ under the sea.
If you like it under sea, you can go under the sea, which is here in the Netherlands for sure. And I keep saying, like, thank you, Theo, for allowing us to use this kind of interesting name. I would be honest, Breda, where we handle the conference, is actually not under the sea, but we can go down in the building. And so you feel the true experience here in the Netherlands. But that's the conference we started last year. And I'm super happy it ran very much, very successfully. And so we're going to have finally 2 days this year. I'm super grateful because I'm the conference chair. And when you're conference chair, program chair, and you have to back, like we had 60 submissions last year, to two tracks in one day, that's a challenge. So I asked our organizers, never do that to me again. So we have 2 days. And the call for paper is actually running. So the conference is in October. The call for paper is open till mid-June. So you still can use your chance to submit. And I encourage everyone to do so. And we have announced one keynote speaker is Sean Parent. I think you all know him, but we also have another keynote speaker. It's he's not on the site yet, but I think I can tease already because we got the official yes, and it's Dr. Walter Brown. So I think that should be an amazing event, and more Absolutely. Keynote speakers are coming. We also have a day of workshop. So please submit and come under the sea.
thank you for the exclusive.
I'm excited about both of those. I think I was going to say, I think CPP on C is probably the top of my, either CPP on C or NDC Tech Town are the top of my list of conferences I have not spoken at and want to. Probably CPP on C is above it. Super excited to do that sometime. This year is all crazy, but I am hopefully doing a lot more speaking. Anthropic was, I think, a little bit like, well, we don't know about this talking to C++ people. And then they saw the response from ACCU and they were like, oh, yeah, let's do a lot more of this. So I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited about all the opportunities to interface with all of you and work on all of these things. And I am actually trying to talk them into letting me submit for CPP under the sea. I'm a little late for CPP on sea, but... Excellent. I mean, it's a small conference to fly all the way across the Atlantic for, but if I can pair it up with some other things, then maybe so.
I hope to see you at all the conferences.
Yeah, I'm super excited.
So let's move on into our topic for today then. Now we have Daisy here. So obviously you mentioned Anthropic, AI, Claude.ai, I think is the main service. But interestingly, Anastasia so our guest co-host today, that you're not obviously not working in an AI company, but JetBrains has been embracing AI tooling recently as well. And both of you gave keynotes at the ACC conference a few weeks ago on the subject of AI in software development. And interestingly, the response was actually quite polarizing. I mean, mostly very good. Great feedback, actually. I had one memory of being in the hallway just after your keynote, Daisy, and I was talking to someone, and they would looked like they were just in a bit of a daze. And they just said that they were still processing what it all meant. It really had a profound impact on them, and I had some other experiences a bit like that as well. So definitely very impactful. But then also heard some concerns from a couple of places, that since you both actually work for companies that either provide the LLM-based AI services, in your case, Daisy, or use them as part of your products, in your case, Anastasia, that there's some sort of bias at play there, that this is, you know, you're just like selling your products. So let's get that out of the way right at the start. Can you address those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll start with saying that Anastasia is absolutely not. She was selling competitors' products. The only demo she did was with Windsurf, which is a direct competitor to JetBrains. So, I mean, let's get that out of the way. There's no profit motive there. I happened to use Claude Code for a lot of my demos because I have free credits there because I work there, and I wasn't going to spend a lot of money on some other AI service just to be unbiased. Maybe I should have, but no, this is not about, I mean, it's certainly not about promoting my own company's product. It's about promoting a shift in the industry. I think the first thing I would say is, yeah, I mean, don't trust me. Like, this is not, I would view any of this with a healthy amount of skepticism, but there's also no like secret cabal plot. Those of you who know me personally know I am honest to a fault, like to a significant fault. I don't think that I would be doing this. I mean, I went to Anthropic because I saw this kind of tide shifting. I submitted this, Phil was on the thread. We were talking about this topic as a keynote topic. I'm not sure if I actually sent it before I started at Anthropic, but it certainly was in my plans well before I even started interviewing at Anthropic. And this was like something I've been wanting to keynote on. It's something I've talked to extensively with Andre Alexandrescu about. Since his last keynote at CPPCon on this,
yeah, that was amazing.
We wanted to kind of update that. And I think, look, I'm not going to lie, Anthropic being ahead of everyone right now in coding benchmarks, and me talking about AI at a coding conference looks suspicious. So, like, I'm not going to deny that. But it is also true that I think that it's only going to get in your way if that is your focus here. Like, I'm not part of some conspiracy. I know you. I'm not trying to say that it's a conspiracy to think that profit motives are real, but I don't know. I'll let Anastasia say what she's going to say too. I think. Yeah, she's absolutely promoting a competitor's product, so she's completely above board on that.
Well, before we hand over to Anastasia, I think you may have even mentioned this in your keynote, but the cause and effect is the way around. You know, you're working at Anthropic because of your interest in AI rather than the other way around. So
absolutely,
it's interest that comes first. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what really happened, to go one step further on that, is I was skeptical of working on AI because I was skeptical of the societal good that could be done, and really diving into where Anthropic stands on a lot of that. It's not perfect, and I continue to kind of push back on things that are not perfect, but it is focused on societal good and societal impact. The ethics team at Anthropic really kind of has overwhelming veto power, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars of lost profits sometimes. So I know the story is out there officially that both Google and Anthropic had very similar to ChatGPT-like models working internally before ChatGPT was released. And there is still kind of a lot of like, well, what if we had, done the thing that we didn't think was right at the time, maybe then we'd be able to do the right thing this time and have a stronger voice. But the ethics team blocked the release of what would have been the revolution that everyone saw ChatGPT to be. So.
Yeah, I think we'll touch a bit on some of the ethics part of it as we go for our main topics in a moment. But just hear from Anastasia, who we move on.
Yeah, I really.
Although you've sort of been covered. But.
I really love what Daisy said about taking it with a grain of salt. And I think that's what everyone should do when they talk about Gen AI and DevTools. And like, you know, in JetBrains, we do dev business for 25 years. And I came here also because I felt that I'm passionate about that. I'm passionate about tooling. So I quite often do speak about tooling. Sorry for that. Just because I love speaking about what I'm passionate about. I mean, like, I'm not working with C++ in production for many years now. I stopped before JetBrains. So I really can't speak about, you know, some in-depth language things. I just don't feel that I'm that expert. So for sure, my passion is tooling. So I do speak about tooling. And AI, Gen AI, actually is disrupting our business a lot in a good way. And we were struggling with that. We were challenging that. We were, you know, all the stages like rejecting that, accepting that. And honestly, speaking about Gen AI and Dev tooling in C++ community is quite a challenging thing because it's much easier to go to, I don't know, JavaScript, TypeScript, Python community now and speak about Gen AI. It will be very easy. But when you speak about that in C++, it gets questions. And people start thinking about that. They came to me talking about all the things that they're questioning around that. And that's actually very good. And I was really happy that during the keynote, Jason asked me like quite many very good questions actually about the quality of the C++ code generated and all that stuff. And quite recently, he actually posted on LinkedIn, I think about a week ago or so, a nice post when he was comparing Claude and ChatGPT and asking to program C++ in the style of Jason Turner. I really love that. I really love that passion to try and learn more from people who are questioning the Gen AI. And I mean, that was the goal for me. I was there not to really not that much to promote the tools. I mean, when I'm wearing a JetBrains t-shirt, I think I'm already promoting that, so I can't escape from that. Matt Godbold was once surprised when he saw me in the regular clothes. So, I mean, I'm doing that by design, and that's it. And unfortunately, maybe you have just to accept that. But talking about Gen AI and C++ was a challenge about, yes, let's raise all these questions, like just talk about them. Let's think about how challenging it is for Gen AI to generate something decent and for you to get it out of the Gen AI. And a lot of conversation, actually. They were questions, they were concerns. And I was happy that the people came and asked me a lot about that. So, I've read some feedback from people who didn't love it, and I think that's fine. I'm always not always a big fan of all the keynotes I'm listening to, I have to be honest. So it's good that people do share their opinion. I read them very carefully, actually, to see if there are indeed the points I could address, and just listen to people, and their feedback was really, really good. So I'm fine with that, and let's keep talking about Gen AI. It's not dead, and it's growing, so I don't think we should just keep silence.
Yeah, well, thank you both. I think it was worth taking that bit of time to cover that, mostly from a non-technical perspective, because it has been a really polarizing topic in the community, and there are some people that won't go near it with a barge pole. As Rainy mentioned, of generative AI, using AI for coding, gets them going the wrong way, and that's fine. Maybe the show won't be for you, but on the other hand, maybe it's worth listening and seeing whether it's something that can change your mind and get you thinking along new lines. So let's actually start with some more sort of philosophical questions on the topic, starting with the sort of the obvious one that people have been asking either directly or perhaps indirectly, which is, you know, it is Gen AI, whether it's Claude or ChatGPT or whatever's built into JetBrains tools, is it going to put us out of work as software developers?
Very unlikely. Every advancement we've had in, like, this is the largest step function that we've had in software engineering probably since programming languages. And I understand that the software engineering ecosystem was a little different in the world where programming languages were invented. But like every time we have seen even just non-step function improvements, look at how IDEs are now compared to 2000, right? What we've just seen is that there's more demand, right? Like there's so much more software that can be written and it can be done. Like, yes, maybe we will end up in a world where software engineers are not paid three times any other profession. I think that that is possible. I think that that is not a terrible outcome. As someone who does make those kinds of salaries, I recognize that, like, I am not necessarily more valuable to society than a doctor or a nurse that I make, you know, two or three times as much as. That is potentially going to change, right? Like, because there is a limited amount of money that can be made off of software, period, but there's so much more that can be built, right? Like, if you had said in the 1950s and 60s, like, this improvement in computing and growth is like, there's only so much market for this, et cetera, et cetera. And then you didn't see like this entire video games industry coming, right? Like the entire video games industry is not something that you ever could have seen coming when we were having improvements in computing in the 60s, 70s, and even early 80s that there's a lot of people employed by that. There's gonna be a lot of spaces that software isn't used in currently that it's going to be used in more. Right. And that AI isn't used in currently that it's going to be used in more. There's a lot of need for infrastructure. I mean, the really good news for C++ developers is that the majority of the AI industry does not know how to read bytecode, does not know how to read assembly, does not know how to vectorize a loop, does not know that Python can't vectorize a loop. Like, these are things that are the listeners of this show are very good at. And all three of the big AI giants are hiring like crazy for that. So if you are good at making programs fast, reach out, seriously, because everyone is capacity bound right now. Right. Everyone is just trying to get more and more instructions through, and their whole stacks are written in Python. Right. Yeah. Like they're like, where could we find a few extra cycles? And you're like, well, have you looked at your entire software stack? There's a huge opportunity for C++ people who are willing to embrace AI. AI agents are going to have to be your teammate in this work, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're going to fall behind people who are willing to use this as a teammate. And this is just going to be, I think, part of it. But if you're willing to do that, like, you have a huge opportunity right now.
So if you're an experienced C++ developer, you've got nothing to worry about then. But what if you're a junior developer just starting out? Isn't the sort of thing that these AI tools can do right now going to make it much harder for them to get their foot on the ladder?
Yeah, I think yes and no. I think on the one hand, onboarding with an AI agent alongside you, if you know how to use it, is just way easier. Onboarding into a large code base and understanding where things are. If you are a junior developer being given a task right now and you have access to an AI tool through your work, I would suggest starting with just copying and pasting the task into the agent and see what it says for recommendations. Like, that is something that was never available to me. Don't just have it do it, because it's not going to do as good of a job as if you were to listen to it, reason with it, and work through it as you go. But like, yeah, I think it is a scary time to be a junior developer, but also I think if you're just starting out in your career right now, and you can learn to prompt from the start, right? You can learn to think about software in terms of prompting. I think that you have a big leg up on people who are going to be slower to adopt that, right? I think that is an important, like, I guess kind of what I'm trying to say is that for me, at least, approaching this entire experience with some humility about the human condition has been really productive. I kind of got forced into that by getting laid off at Google, which was an incredibly humbling experience. And I was in this spot in my career where I was kind of open to being humble about things, and then kind of got connected to AI in a way that I was just in the perfect mindset for it. And I know that, like, if you're not willing to approach this with humility about the human condition, me saying it's maybe not going to change your mind. But if you're somewhere in the middle, maybe thinking about, you know, what we're good at and what machines are good at, and trying to figure out how to maximize the things you're good at.
Right.
And that's going to be large scale design. That's going to be ideas. That's going to be thinking about how other humans work, right? And what they want from your software. Thinking about how your collaborators work and how they interact with the code that you write. All of those things are things you have to add on top of AI. And those are things that junior developers, as kind of, especially people who are in undergrad right now or in high school right now, you have the opportunity to be part of the first kind of AI native developer generation. And that could give you a big leg up on people who have been doing this for 30 years, because they're restarting from scratch too, to some extent.
I actually want to confirm that with example. I've recently read about a hackathon at MIT, and it was actually seen there that the much younger people are more bold because, like, they think that they can do much more with the AI, and sometimes they really can. And so they don't have this kind of, you know, artificial limitation that that's not going to work. And yeah, it might sound like they're just young, greenish, and can't understand things, but on the other side of the spectrum, it makes them bring a much better result sometimes, because they're bolder and they're not afraid of doing the, you know, all these technical depths. It's nothing to them. They just go to AI and they actually build cool things. And it was a hackathon with GenAI, and they just proved that they can build cool things in much shorter time. So that's already happening, actually.
Yeah. So the starting points are changing, but so also the approaches. And just means that those people that don't have that baggage of what we've done before can get further ahead faster. So actually, in a way, maybe even more opportunity, I think is what you're saying. So that's quite a positive way to look at it. So I like that. Then let's just think about how the tools that we have available now, today, we know tomorrow it's going to be different, maybe even next week from what we were saying before the show. But right now, how can we use tools like Claude, ChatGPT, or any of the others to help us in software development as someone that maybe is a bit more experienced, perhaps?
Yeah, I would say agents are probably very much likely to be the future. I think this whole code complete mode is a bit passing. I also want to, like, looking maybe, a few months into the future, which is the month is the AI world for years. It looks like potentially, I think, vibe coding. I know we're going to talk about vibe coding more specifically later, but I think this mode of vibe coding is maybe a somewhat passing phase also, I think. I think that... Yeah, I think this idea that you write this really crappy code that doesn't live for very long, and you cordon it off into some part of your code that you're not going to touch, and then you just embrace the vibes because it works, is, I think that, agents are going to get much, much better at sustainable code. Agents are going to get much, much better about thinking long term. I think these are the things, these are the big, you know, part of the problem is that everything has been driven so far by I'm realizing I'm tangenting and not even answering the question, but the part of everything so far has been driven by these benchmarks, right? Like you sell software based on how well you, you sell LLMs based on how well you do on SweetBench. And that's a huge fraction of it. And so it's really driven by which AIs are the best at just getting something working. And I think we're going to very quickly realize that that is not a sustainable way to do software. But I would get used to a tool. Here's, so here's the thing that I did when I got to Anthropic that has really, really helped me, especially if you're at a company that has one of these tools available. Mm-hmm. Be stubborn. Be stubborn for a week. Go 1 week without writing code. Like, this sounds crazy, but go 1 week without writing code by yourself. Just be stubborn for that week. Make yourself make the AI generate things.
Okay.
Right? Like, there's this this whole proverb about teach a person to fish, right? And there's kind of another step there. It's like teach a person to teach. And then, mm-hmm. you know, all of the people that they can teach to fish will benefit from that, right? And what you're really learning by doing that exercise, by being stubborn about saying, I will not write a line of code for a week. Now, maybe you don't have that time. I totally understand. Like, yeah. software engineering is, I'm not saying that I have that time either. I'm saying that I worked longer than I should for that week. But like, learning how to teach something to an AI agent, learning how to tell an agent to do something when you're not allowed to touch the code yourself for whatever reason will actually improve your efficiency a lot. And so I really would suggest trying that exercise, or maybe some smaller version of that. Maybe you say, you know, between 3 and 5 PM every day for a week, I will not write a line of code. I will only use code that I am able to generate through prompting.
So it's naturally like practicing your prompt engineering skills.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's very frustrating. I will tell you right away, it's very frustrating. And then it gets to be easier, right? The first day you're just going to be like, I just want you to write this code. And then by the end, it does get easier. You get used to the kinds of mistakes it makes. Mm-hmm. You get used to the things that you forget to say. One, so we put out a blog post on agentic coding best practices recently, my team at Anthropic. And I think all of those apply to any agent you want to use, whether it's Claude Code, whether it's this Codex thing that OpenAI has recently put out, whether it is or Cursor is another agentic, primarily agentic first thing. And there's quite a lot of other ones out there, and like there's definitely a technique to this. There is a best practices to all of this. Get it to ask you questions. Tell it to say, don't write any code before you've asked me 3 clarifying questions. Right? You will be surprised at the things that it didn't understand if you tell it to jump back in, right? The whole notion of extended thinking is basically just telling the AI to think, right? And that's basically it. It's like, you know, a prompt engineering thing is telling the AI to think. And you can extend that idea to like tell the AI to ask you questions, tell the AI to ask another AI for permission to make changes, right? Like, play around with these things. There's a lot of ways you can put fail safes into the system. I will say, if you're coding by yourself, this gets very expensive very quickly. And I wish I had better answers for that, right? It bugs me constantly that this is way cheaper at a company, or way easier, more accessible if you already have a job than if you don't.
Yeah.
And we can talk about the ethics of that and my thoughts on that later. Using an agent is not going to be efficient if you're trying to minimize the number of tokens you use.
Right.
You're going to use a lot more time.
Mm-hmm.
So
what you were saying sounds like the idea of coding katas, where you you do some sort of exercise in a self-contained way just to learn how to do it or learn
yep.
some skill along the way. And that skill could be how you talk to an LLM to get the work done. Because in my experience, one of the obstacles is that it does feel like you're talking to a human, but the way that they respond is not like a human, in that you can give them a one-sentence summary of the problem, and they seem to have it all sussed out right at the start. But then, as you say, there's these big holes in their assumptions that you need to probe mm-hmm. at to get at. And it's almost like the reverse of talking to a human, where you hit the assumptions straight away, and, well, you sometimes hit those holes straight away, and then you get to an understanding a bit later. But you sort of have to work backwards to it. At least that's been my experience. So, yeah, spending a bit of time feeling out how that works is what will get you where you want to go faster, I think. So.
Yeah, and that also leads people to the major concern regarding the vibe coding. And Dave, maybe you can address that, because it's like they see the vibe coding as a disruption to their profession, but also as a disruption to the quality. Because who knows what is generated there when you vibe coding, right? Mm. Because you don't look into the code. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I'll start by saying I don't work in security critical areas usually. Right. So I get that someone would be very worried if their bank's security code is being written in a vibe coding approach. The other thing about vibe coding that I will say is that we've been doing it for a while, right? Like if you were a senior engineer, you absolutely know how to minimize the damage that a junior engineer can do. I don't want to say it. That sounds like a really stuck up way to say it. But if you're a senior engineer listening to me here, you're probably nodding, right? Like, and I'm not saying that all junior engineers, if you're a junior engineer listening to this podcast, you're probably not one of those people, right? Like if you're listening to a podcast in your free time as a junior engineer, you're probably not the person that they're trying to minimize the damage of. But software engineering as a practice has been structured over many years to create self-contained units, self-contained modules that can minimize the damage they can do to other modules, right? And that is not changing, right? Like people are so surprised that these are like, oh, this is going to mess up our entire code base. And like, no, you are still in charge of creating the structures that minimize the damage of something going wrong in one place. And that's software engineering, that's not programming, right?
Yeah.
Software engineers are going to keep doing software engineering. They may not do much programming. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important distinction to make here, right? Yeah. You are still going to be in charge of structuring your program, of designing abstractions that can separate concerns in ways that the damage from something going wrong is minimized. And that has been the past 50 years of software engineering, right? We have had people who can write bad code for as long as this profession has been around. And that's going to continue. It's just that it's happening faster. And so that your ability to isolate those things is even more important than it's ever been. And because of that, people who can leverage that ability are really going to thrive. And people who cannot are not really going to have vibe coding accessible to them. And so they're going to slow down a lot, right? That's really what's happening, is that vibe coding is going to create a lot of bad code. And people who can't create structures that contain that are going to fall behind people who can. So your skills are still there. Your skills are still extremely valuable. And that the secret is that this has always been the case, right? It's just happening a lot faster, and so it's amplified, right? The inability to contain this bad code into units that are very well testable, that are unlikely to affect the rest of your code base, is amplified because it's happening so quickly, and there's so much of it happening. So you have 10 years of, you know, kind of bad or poorly written code getting added to your code base in a month. And people are like, oh my gosh, the world is falling apart. And yeah, if you didn't have structures that were going to work over that 10-year period, then they also won't work over that month period. It's just that in that 10-year period, you could have a lot more time for people to find those bugs, find those shortcomings. And I think people with really well-structured code are seeing kind of exponential benefits already. And people with poorly structured code are seeing spaghetti already.
Yeah, we want more lasagna, less spaghetti.
Yes, exactly.
How can we get a better one? I mean, people were coming to me and asking at ACC a lot, and I realized that I don't have a good answer here, maybe. So quite experienced people, those who are like training people to write better C++ code, they had a reasonable question. So how can we make LLMs write better C++ code? How can we contribute? You've been working in Anthropic. You probably is a proper person to ask that. So how can people who can write good code teach those agents and LLMs to write better C++ code, at least to some extent?
Yeah. One of my friends at Anthropic is in charge of the reinforcement learning team, the code reinforcement learning team, the reinforcement learning specifically focused on coding abilities. And she and I have had a lot of talks about this. And one thing we have to do in the industry is get rid of living benchmark to benchmark. Like, this has got to stop. You're not going to, you know, if you're selling your product based on benchmarks, then you're going to get benchmark like code. And you can only make software projects so big in RL before it becomes impractical to tune on them, right? You can't have a project that it takes a week for the AI to figure out and then, you know, iterate on that. You can't run for 1 week and then be like, okay, it did slightly better than the previous one, so we're going to take a step in the direction of the weight change. Like, that's not how these things work, right? You do have to be able to do some of these things very quickly. But I do think that we have to start doing reinforcement learning specifically for code quality. I would love to see a dry benchmark, which is like measures how dry the code, don't repeat yourself, the code generated by AI agents is. I'd love to see those kinds of things actually happening in the industry where we actually measure code quality by various metrics and put a benchmark out for that. I think that is challenging with the way the economics of the industry is going right now, but I think it's something that we need to look very seriously at as an industry, especially in systems languages, right? If you're making a website and you're making the front end, and it's going to be relatively well contained to a single web page or a series of web pages, whatever. But if you're editing the Linux kernel, like, this is a different beast altogether, right?
Yeah.
And so I think code quality, you know, I had one of my agents, one of the things that I was using an agent for the other day, I was doing a code review of it, and rather than trying to figure out how to put the two pieces of code in the same place, it just duplicated the entire main function, which was, you know, 200 lines or something like that. And I asked it why, and it was like, oh, yeah, that was a really bad idea. Let me go fix it. And then it went and fixed it, right? Like, it wasn't a big deal, but it got me thinking to, like, where was the AI ever incentivized in the reinforcement learning process to make those pieces of code match? And I don't know that it really was. I think I have to be careful what I say about reinforcement learning, because a lot of that is very trade secrety and stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, I don't actually even know enough to know what I'm not allowed to say and what I'm allowed to say. So I'm going to be very careful about that. But I will say, I can say this, like, if you've been frustrated with the quality of C++ it generates, none of these models have been fine-tuned on C++ code very heavily. the entire industry is focused on Python. The one benchmark that matters by far the most, SweetBench, is 12 Python projects. So everything is fine-tuned around Python. In fact, a lot of models are kind of fine-tuned to do badly on C++ currently. Let me explain. One of the ways that you interact with an LLM's output and you can get it to make some sort of sections to its response that are like parsable in a reliable way is that you teach it how to use XML very well, right? You teach it how to say, if I start you completing after an XML tag, you will put everything that goes into that XML tag, you know, within that XML tag, and then you will close it. Now, and we do a lot of reinforcement learning on this. A lot of other companies do. This is not a secret, right? It's really a very easy type of kind of customizable open-close thing that you can do. It's very easy to parse out by, you know, by the rest of the software that interacts with the LLM. And what does an open XML tag look like? It looks like a template. Like, LLMs are being conditioned to write very bad C++, and yet you're getting the results you're seeing, right? Now, imagine a world in which we've done better than that. Like, that's it, when I learned that, I just laughed out loud. I was like, wow, like, how much better could these things be at C++ if we start actually training them on it and not counter-training them? Like, it has to, every time it sees std vector of int, it has to go against its training to figure out that it is not writing a summary of something related to int and then closing that off with a slash int XML. It goes through all of those gymnastics and then starts trying to, you know, continue writing the code. And it's doing as well as it's doing now. So, I mean, I think I don't really buy that AI has plateaued. Like, that's yeah. One of those anecdotes that was just like, I think I probably thought, I am a bit of a technophile. I definitely am a bandwagon jumper. I am definitely drinking the Kool-Aid at Anthropic. I am fully admit all of those things. But when I see things like that, I'm like, there is no way that we are at the point where we've plateaued. These things are so easy to fix. Right? It's just no one asked a C++ developer whether angle brackets was a problematic syntax to use for something else.
Yeah, I always knew that XML had done a lot of damage, but I had no idea it was that bad.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
You touched on a topic that I've seen a lot of, and I know Anastasia has commented on this before as well, but there seem to be like these two modes that it will operate in. One, when you're actually getting it to write some code, and it can knock out some code, but it's not following any of these best practices or design principles or anything. When you point that out, it knows exactly what the problem is, and it can go and fix it, as you say. It's like there's two different personalities, and you have to pit them against each other. Is there sort of any, maybe this is something you can't talk about, but is there any work being done to try to merge those so you don't have to teach it about itself?
So there's a few things. One is that we haven't done a lot of constitutional AI is something that Anthropic more or less invented, but it's being used everywhere now, which is basically where you give, in your reinforcement learning, you give it a document of best practices in a particular area, and then you have another AI judge the training AI's completion of that or adherence to that constitution, right? And so, and then you let the one that's being trained evolve based on whether or not it adhered to that constitution. And so this is really important in things like ethics, where say you're trying to, you want to defend against someone trying to build a chemical weapon based on knowledge they get out of the AI, if you give it a constitution that says you are not allowed to say this, this is much more effective than a system prompt. System prompts are very hackable. We know this.
Yeah.
At this point, you can tell it to ignore everything you've seen already, right? And like, we're a long ways away from that being the way around it, but there's still lots of other ways around it. It's really effective in that area, but I don't think we've really explored it in the area of coding best practices, where you have kind of a constitutional AI set up with a coding best practices document, and then you reward or punish the AI based on how well it adheres to that constitution. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that over the next 6 months. And I think I still think the incentives have to be in the right place, right? This industry has to change how they're thinking about reporting incentives, and it can't just be benchmarks. And I say this as the company that is clearly leading in benchmarks. Like, we are profiting off of these benchmarks, and I do not think that it is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
I think that we need to be... And I'm not the only one to say that at Anthropic, by the way. Like, that there are plenty of people who will very openly say that, very important people. And so I do think we need to think about where our incentives are. But then I think if the incentives are there, we have plenty of ways to do this. I think another thing is that we need to get better at agentic setups that involve multiple agents. And I've played around with this a little bit in my work. As we build out agents, you can imagine that you would have, instead of one agent interacting with a human, you have one agent interacting with a human and another agent. And the other agent has been instructed to go ask about best practices every time before coming back to the human. So the loop goes something like, you know, the worker agent will actually, you know, start writing all of the code and everything. And then maybe anytime that it wants to make an edit to the code, it has to ask the other agent first. And then it can ask the human, you know, if the other agent approves of its edit. Or if you're doing a kind of more autonomous loop, you say every time the edit has to be approved by the other agent, and then before even coming back to the user, the other agent asks it these questions, right? Very specific questions about, hey, are lines, you know, 293 through 475, is that really the best dry code you could write? Or could it be the same? Could it be done in lines, you know, 23 through whatever? Those kinds of things are... These are not giant, this is low-hanging fruit in the industry, right? Like, hooking two AIs up to each other is not some revolutionary idea. It's like one of the first things you would think to try. And we just haven't done that in a systematic way yet, because there's too many other things advancing and everything is changing too quickly. Now imagine, you know, this mixture of experts is a big thing that has come up in the past, I almost said year, 3 months? 4 months? When was January? I don't know. 4 months ago?
Years ago.
Mixture of experts has been a big deal in the industry lately. And if you really were to have a subset of that, where you have an expert on software design, an expert on coding practices, observing an expert on generating code, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of much more specialized, much more granular version of mixture of experts than most people are talking about these days. But it's not entirely unreasonable in the next 6 months.
Yeah, so it sounds like pair programming is valuable even for AI agents.
Absolutely. Maybe, and we see this even, yeah, we see this even with group programming, right? I often tell it to ask three sub-agents. This is something you can do with Claude. I don't know about any of the others. Claude Code, I don't know about any of the others, but you can specifically ask it. Use three sub-agents to check your work. Make sure all three of them agree before you move on, right? And if they disagree, then ask a fourth one to resolve the disagreement. I do that quite frequently. It sounds like, you know, sounds like a cheat code. you're going to use a lot of tokens doing that. And if you're paying by the token personally, then I'm sorry. That sucks. And this industry needs to really think about how it treats the open source world. So we can talk about that at some point. But if you're working with this in your day-to-day job, and your company is paying for your tokens, that is actually a really good way to get better code out of your time.
Well, we're just getting going here, scratching the surface, but we're already running over time. We should probably experiment with the serialization approach, but I know you both have to go off to do other things as well, so we won't do that this time. So we're going to have to start wrapping up, but I do want to get back to one maybe more philosophical or maybe more ethical question, which is all this use of LLMs obviously comes at an energy cost, and that's been talked about a lot. So is that really something we should be worried about? Is that going to be the same long term?
So a lot of advancement. So I will start with this. A lot more of the evolution of AI efficiency is coming from people writing better code and faster code, right, for actually doing inference, for actually running the AI. There's this term in the industry called a compute multiplier, which is like, it's the most trade secret of trade secrets, right alongside our weights, right? Which is like, this is how we are able to speed up from one model to another. You know, the amount of compute used is not growing with the size of the models.
Right.
It is actually sublinear, because, you know, there is a lot of money being put into making these things more efficient. I definitely struggle with the carbon cost of these models in the short term. I think one of the things that we can really do is to make sure that these things are really good at innovating in clean energy. I think that being responsible about the way we train them to have the right skill sets to accelerate those areas of research, I think is a very responsible thing to be doing. Like, I think there is the discussion of, oh, you know, all of this carbon's being used and it's getting out of control. And I completely agree with those things. But I also think that there's not enough discussion being had about how much this could accelerate our search for green energy, how much this could accelerate our search for sustainable programs. I think that we need to be reasonable as an AI company about, maybe this is the time when I should say my opinions are entirely my own and do not represent my employer. Maybe cut that out and put it at the beginning. I don't know. But I think that we should probably be granting discounts to green energy research labs. I think we should be thinking about ways in which our model could accelerate research and putting money behind that. Right. I think we have said a lot. If you read Dario's essay, our CEO at Anthropic, is an essay on his view of the futurism around AI. And it's a really kind of positive take, optimistic view. It's a really good essay, Machines of Loving Grace. I recommend anyone read it. It's one of the things that convinced me to come to Anthropic.
Right.
But he talks about this, right? He talks about like how, like, yes, there's a lot of carbon being used in this pursuit, but we have to also account for the potential gains in clean energy. And that sounds like an excuse. I absolutely understand it sounds like an excuse. If I were on the other side of this, I'd be like, that's an excuse. I don't think we're going to stop it just by saying that it's generating a lot of carbon. Right, there are enough people who don't care about the amount of carbon that's generating that will get ahead of the rest of us. Yeah. And then we just won't have a seat at the table anymore. Right.
Yeah.
But I think as a company that controls one of the best models for reasoning and science, I think that we could be better about singling out, you know, wind and solar energy research companies. I have my own personal opinions on nuclear, and I think that we should be spinning up more nuclear plants right now to bridge the gap to when we actually have sustainable wind and solar. But I understand that's a controversial opinion among leftists, and I am counting myself there. But I think that very careful nuclear, I think that fusion research really, really needs to be kicked forward by all of this. We've never had more of a need for energy. And I you know, it bugs me. It does bug me, for sure, the amount of power being used. I think there's some simple things we can do that are like, maybe remind people of their carbon footprint when they finish using Cloud Code. And that is a feature request we've had. It's something that I've reached out to our environmental impact team on, and hopefully we'll add at some point. There's not a real easy way to do that right now, so we're trying to figure out a way to do it. But like, I think that Anthropic is one of the companies that's willing to do this, even at the expense of profit. Like, if reminding people of their carbon footprint means they use Claude Code less, I think we're okay with doing that.
Okay. Good to know.
And that's why I'm there. I wouldn't be there otherwise. Anyone who's sat down over drinks with me and talked politics knows that that is absolutely the case. But I think having people who are really bothered by this, working on this, is very important.
Well, I think you brought that background to a positive note to finish on. So thank you for that. I thought we were going to end on a down note, but but we got there. That's great. And as I say, there's so much more we could talk about, but we are at risk of burning too much carbon ourselves right now. So we will stop here. Maybe we'll set up a follow-up at some point. But thank you so much for giving your time and coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was amazing.
You're very welcome. Well, I think we'll have to skip our usual closing question about what else in the world of C++ excites you. Which is, we'll save that for next time.
Sorry, I talk too much.
Not at all.
I'm not very good at generating stop tokens. So.
But is there anything else that you want to tell people, or somewhere that people can find you if they want to reach out to find out more?
I mean, if I am allowed a shameless plug, we are hiring like crazy. Anyone who is good at instruction counting and understanding performance, anyone who is good with accelerators especially. We had a direct call from our CEO last week. Was that only last week? Wow. Last week.
Months ago.
To reach out to anyone we know who's good at performance tuning. And I was like, oh, that's my whole community. How do I narrow that down? But if anything that I said appeals to you, reach out. We have performance tuning a website. For those of you that have my contact information, reach out to me, or reach out to me on, I guess I'm still on Twitter. I'm not there very often. Blue Sky X. I think my email is on my website or something like that, that I haven't updated in 2 years. But I think I'm probably talking to 15 people right now from our community about trying to get just better expertise in fast computing into the AI world. And I think there's a lot of benefits to be had there. And I really do believe that we're the company that's doing it the right way. I know that sounds cheesy and it sounds very bandwagon-y, but reach out and just really appreciate the opportunity to talk again. This is really cool. And thank you.
Oh, thank you for coming on. And thank you for all of that. And thank you, Anastasia, for being an excellent co-host as well.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. So, thank you. Thank you, Phil.
We'll see you all next time.
See ya. Thanks so much for listening in as we chat about C++. We'd love to hear what you think of the podcast. Please let us know if we're discussing the stuff that you're interested in. Or if you have a suggestion for a topic, we'd love to hear about that too. You can email all your thoughts to feedback@cppcast.com. We'd also appreciate it if you can follow CPPcast at CPPcast on X or at Mastodon at cppcast.com on Mastodon and leave us a review on iTunes. You can find all of that info and the show notes on the podcast website at cppcast.com. The theme music for this episode was provided by podcastthemes.com.